Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Two interviews today. First, Rachel Kushner talks about her terrific novel, The Flamethrowers, and then the sociologist Mark Mizrachi talks about the decay of the U.S. business class. Time's short, so right on to Rachel Kushner. Her novel, The Flamethrowers, is an ambitious and marvelous thing, smart, stylish, and complex. It's told through the voice of a working-class young woman from Reno who travels between the art world of New York and the proto-revolutionary Italy of the mid-1970s. Connecting them is her artist boyfriend, an heir to an Italian fortune. Through him, she watches the revolutionary upsurge from a largely unappealing upper-class family that makes you want to forget your reservations about the violent revolutionaries, the Red Brigades, though later on she does get out into the revolutionary networks of Rome. It involves lots of motorcycles, too. Rachel Kushner. Welcome, Rachel Kushner. First of all, congratulations. Very fine novel. I'm just impressed by the ambition and scope of it, but also its quality from sentence to sentence. So congratulations.
Well, thank you.
I'm curious how, I remember William Faulkner said he got the inspiration for The Sound and the Fury by seeing a little girl's muddy underpants in a tree. And that gave rise to that large, complex novel. How did you get started on this? What was the inspiration?
I relate in a way to various things Faulkner has said about the way that the image can inform the inception of what becomes a novel, only because I also seem to land on a kind of image, whether it's a poetic image or a visual image. It doesn't seem to make much of a difference for me, and I start from that and then build around it. And in this case, there were a few things. First of all, rubber and the figure of rubber. I started thinking about it. I was interested in artists in the early 1970s in New York City who used rubber as a material in their work. And I started thinking about how they were all moving into these former manufacturing warehouses in Soho. And much of what they used for their work was just detritus that had been put out on the street as these places were transformed from sites of industry to sites for art making. And it seemed, you know, without over intellectualizing it, it seemed like very telling about that moment in the 1970s and the death of industry in the United States. And so I just started kind of following the course of rubber. And then thinking about how rubber is made and that, entire forests are sort of conscripted into service when they harvest wild rubbers has been done in South America. And then you get into World War II and Vietnam and the different ways in which rubber has been affected by and has affected, you know, these kinds of global shifts and wars. So rubber was one image for me, and then a couple of others, just quickly, were the blackout in New York City in July of 1977. You know, it seems to have become a kind of cliche about a moment of surprise in which people were dismayed at the behavior, you know, of poor black people in Brooklyn and the Bronx, and you know, why couldn't they behave themselves like they did in the quote-unquote good blackout of 1965 when everyone acted in a very genteel and neighborly manner? And how could you loot a local business? So I was thinking about that day and just the images from that day. And as I started to work in a theme of Italian politics and what was going on in the autonomous movement in Italy at this exact same time, I mean, it's called the Movement of 77, I hit upon a particular day in that movement, which was March 12th, 1977. There was a massive rally in Rome. And I just was sort of thinking about that and the images of the blackout, and it was a place from which I began.
I was actually thinking about the connection between the looting in New York and the more political looting in Italy. There's a depoliticized quality to the American looting and a very politicized quality to the Italian.
Yes, that's right.
The 70s. I have very fond memories of New York in the 70s. It's when I fell in love with the city, and I also spent the summer of 76 in Italy. So, I mean, these places, like, this speaks to me. But you were in grade school in the 70s. Why this interest in the 1970s?
Well, I've written about contemporary art for a fairly long time now, you know, 15 years. And writing about art, one of the things I've really enjoyed about that endeavor is that, yeah, I'm more or less self-taught as a quote-unquote art critic. I don't really think of myself as a critic, but I have written a lot about art. And one of the things I enjoy about the challenge of doing that is that you have to give yourself a crash course in art history. And the 70s are just a very particular time in the New York art world, and to me, one of the great eras when really wonderful thought took place. And I always wondered and asked myself if it had something to do with urban blight and the fact that the economy had more or less bottomed out. It was, I didn't know if it was a romantic idea or not to think that it was an era in which people could move to New York City with so little and pick up a menial, just a low-wage job and work part-time and have room and space and time to make work. And so if that were really the case, and I think that it was the case, it seemed like a fun time to write about. And also I was exposed, even though I was a child, I was exposed to the New York of that era, at least enough to know where to go and what to read and who to talk to in order to try to summit it into reality in the form of a book. I have an aunt who is a video artist, Dede Halleck, and we would go to visit her, and her son worked for Richard Serra, and I spent a lot of time, you know, wandering around a kind of dark and dangerous Soho with him in his truck. And then the summer of 1980, when I was, I guess, 11, I lived with a friend of mine and her mother on Mulberry Street in Little Italy. And the mother and her boyfriend both worked at 101 Spring Street, which is the Donald Judd's building. And at the time, I didn't care who Donald Judd was. I paid very little attention. I just thought her mother and her friends, you know, drank too much, smoked too much, stayed up too late arguing about art. I didn't know what they were talking about. They, you know, were very poor. There were giant roaches in the apartment. I cared more about the kind of liveliness of the street because it was a lawless renegade world run by the Italian mafia. And we got to uncap fire hydrants and steal clothes and do whatever we wanted. But I think that some of the exposure to the art world filtered in somewhere to my unconscious. And for better or worse, it gave me some kind of license to write about that world, even if I only witnessed it through the eyes of an 8-year-old, 9-year-old, 10-year-old.
Yeah, those spaces are now probably worth $5 billion and inhabited by hedge fund traders.
Well, the Donald Judd building is still owned by what's called the Judd Foundation, and they just rehabilitated it. But the value of art and the means to rehabilitate that building, you know, are a product of the fact that hedge fund managers have figured out that art is an excellent investment.
Yes. Yeah, well, actually, I moved to New York in 1979, and I remember going to Loft in Soho and listening to a band which later became Liquid Liquid. The place was a dump and was falling apart, and there were like 12 people all broke listening to them. And, you know, then I was in New York for the rest of the 80s and watched it turn into a branch of Wall Street. It was a remarkable transformation in the space of a decade.
It must have been. I didn't live there in the 80s, but I could well imagine. And I guess I see my novel in a way as being, what's the expression? Pre-lapsarian in that sense, although, you know, it's not meant to be read.
Well, but there was also the fiscal crisis, which felt like a fall itself. So it was before and after a fall. But it made life very cheap, and you could have a loft in Soho for next to nothing. Now, why Italy? Why the fascination with the Italian 70s?
Well, came together, that part of it, in a rather organic manner. My husband, Jason Smith, writes a lot about French and Italian political thought, and he was reviewing the reissue of Semiotext collection on Italy called, it's just called Autonomia. And I didn't even know what autonomia was at the time. And this was back in 2005 or something like that. And he had been a student of Michael Hart's and had been following that work for a long time. And I became interested in it. And he and I have a lot of crossover just in general cultural interest in Italy. I have a lot of friends there. I spent my junior year abroad there. I speak Italian. So we started going to Italy together. And he introduced me to philosopher friends of his who either were directly involved in the autonomous movement or have studied it or were peripherally involved with it. They were just talking about, you know, there's a lot of anecdotes and stories and myths. And I started asking people about this stuff. And I realized that there was just no question about whether or not to put it in the novel. It was happening at the exact same time as these events were occurring in the New York art world. And even if it's a different arena, it was just an instinctual and instantaneous decision on my part to incorporate it. And so I began to go to Italy just on research trips to talk to people about it. And I realized I had a kind of incredible set of resources in terms of being able to query people who were really on the scene, who were there and knew what that time was like.
A friend of mine says you're also involved in radical philosophy circles. Is that?
Well, that's really through, I guess so. I mean, it's really through my husband, Jason. I've met a lot of people through him, and I guess they are now my friends as well. I mean, I'm not, do you mean like the journal Radical Philosophy or?
Curious about how your philosophical interests merged with your novelistic ones.
Right. Well, I guess in the form of this book, maybe they did merge a little bit. Although, you know, I try to handle quote unquote ideas with a very light hand in fiction. Fiction is its own special thing. And, you know, it's not a place to just go bonkers expository in what you know about a particular milieu. You know, it really kind of have to filter up through the internal requirements of the fictional space. But it probably didn't hurt that I do know a lot of people in semi-radical milieu. And while I was writing the book, you know, there's a lot of stuff happening in the actual world around me. And I was surrounded by people who were involved in, for instance, you know, Occupy Oakland. And my husband translated the first text of Tikkun, the anonymous political collective in France. He was the first person to translate that into English. So, you know, I have friends who are involved with Endnotes. I don't know if you are familiar.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know, those people are good. Most of them are good friends, John Clegg and Maya Gonzalez and Aaron Beninoff. And those are people that I talk to a lot, and their knowledge is different than mine. It's much more technical. I'm not, you know, a Marxist in that regard that I am any kind of expert in political thought. I'm not. But I have access to people who are.
I'm speaking with Rachel Kushner, author of The Flamethrowers from Scribner. Well, thank God for the light hand, because a novel that is weighted down by too much politics is not something one would necessarily want to read. It's interesting that you look at the troubles in Italy in the 70s through the eyes mostly of a very high bourgeois family. Had you a direct experience of that milieu, or is it entirely imagined?
Well, it's mostly looked at through the eyes not of the bourgeois family, but of the narrator, who is a working class young woman from Reno, Nevada.
But she experiences a lot of it through being at the villa and, you know, the experience of the family's anxieties and but also the narrator's experience of class, of being condescended to and spoken of in an Italian that they forgot she understood.
Right. No, I suppose you're right. Well, I mean, that's sort of complicated. The reasons, you know, why I decided to do that are manifold. But the art world, the contemporary art world in Italy has always sort of been ruled by this kind of either just unapologetic, reactionary, upper crust bourgeoisie or this sort of radical chic type of thing. These people in Milan, they have a lot of money, they run a gallery or they collect art. There's a guy named Count Panza who famously, you know, bought all the minimalist work of the American minimalists. And they come from this world of classes and not masses. And I have been exposed to that to some degree. I stayed at a residency that's run by a baronessa, and she's not in the book, but that world was, it was a kind of, I guess, very elucidating, eye-opening experience for me. And I think that it's just part and parcel of understanding the culture of Italy. It's just, it's very trenchant there, this idea of an upper crust. I mean, there still is an aristocracy in Italy, and the people who kind of have cultural means in the north all come from these families, and they all know one another. And I wanted to deal in a larger way with these strong lines that go all the way back through the 20th century, you know, beginning with futurism and then going on to an industrial culture and a design culture. And so she happens to meet this boyfriend who's connected to all of that. And so it seemed natural that I partly tell the story of an encounter with a reaction to all that through his eyes, if that makes sense.
Yes. Yeah, I was thinking, as I was reading it, of I think the Italian upper business class is called the Good Table, the Salotto Buono, that's all around this Medio Banca. So it's a very small world at the top of Italian society.
Yeah, it's tiny. And all these people, you know each other. But of course, I did try to have her escape all of that and then encounter another world in Rome. And I guess I purposely kept it to the perspective of an unknowing outsider, because it seemed maybe just like I could do a better job of it that way, or it would be more fun for me to detail all of that from an impressionistic point of view rather than a knowing point of view. And it's not really the question of me not being able to know because I'm not an Italian and I wasn't there, but more that it's a more suitable challenge for an American writer to write it from that perspective, I guess.
And she never has a proper name. She's known by her place of origin.
Yeah, when I was writing the novel, I never once thought of her as Reno. It's sort of funny. She, to me, is a purely unnamed narrator. There's something about names. Perhaps it's a little abstract, but you have to be named from the outside. You can't name yourself. And it's a question to me of whether the individual can ever truly absorb and incorporate the name. I wanted her to feel for the reader like a perception that they were totally bounded to and were not afforded any kind of objective view of her. And a name would have given her that. We could have looked at her and not through her eyes. And so I just decided that she was going to be completely unnamed, but then there are, you know, a couple points in the narrative where maybe even just once where she's jokingly referred to as Reno. And then for technical reasons at the end, when Sandro, the boyfriend, speaks, he refers to her as that. But that was kind of more something that happened upon publication because reviewers have to have a name. They can't just keep saying the narrator. It's clunky sounding. And so now she's Reno. But as I wrote it, she was just a blank.
Well, I think of the comedian and performance artist Reno in New York. I don't know if you know her, so she always popped to mind as I was reading the book.
Is she someone contemporary?
Yeah, oh yeah, she's a pal of mine of sorts. She lives downtown and does political performance art and stand-up comedy.
Oh, well, that, I like that. That's a happy coincidence, I guess.
But yeah, you chose to tell us the story through her rather than the omniscient narrator.
Yeah, well, when you say the omniscient narrator, are you...
And as a technique, and an omniscient narrator.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't really seem like that gets used a whole lot anymore, which isn't to say that that's a reason not to do it, but there are reasons to avoid the omniscient narrator. I kind of like the old guard use of it. Like, I love Victor Hugo, and, you know, in The Toilers of the Sea, he just writes however many 100-something pages on, you know, the inhabitants of Guernsey and what they farm and the seasons there and all that kind of stuff. But in a modern novel, it's a tough call to make that go over well. But more than that, I wanted a first-person narrator, but I wanted one that sort of violates all of the conventional wisdoms in regard to the justifying reasons for deciding on a first-person narrator. Like, one is always told, don't use a first-person narrator unless they have a very inflected, idiomatic, voicey voice.
Who says that?
Well, writing teachers. It's sort of a classic piece of received wisdom. But there are many examples of a first-person narrator that doesn't have a voicey voice. That's more kind of like a, not quite water, but neutral and intent on reading like thought. I mean, I think that Proust is that kind of first-person narrator. And I had just read The Savage Detectives by Roberto Bolaño. And like a lot of writers, I was really influenced by that book. And I loved the way that it was told in the first person, but in the most sly and subtle way. And at certain points in the book, you're not even sure if he's witnessing what it is he's reporting on as other people go on and on and on in telling stories and kind of running away with the narrative. And so I was, I guess, enabled or inspired to do a little of that in my book as well.
And this is a question that, as a nonfiction writer, I always wonder what fiction writers do. As you write, is there an imagined reader?
I have been asked that question before, and I'm trying to remember exactly what I said.
You could come up with a different answer, but you don't have to be consistent.
I don't think that, no, I know, it's better to just be in the moment and answer, you know, in terms of what comes to the mind. No, I don't think that there is an imagined reader, but there's something complicated going on, probably for all writers, but of course I can only speak for me. There's something complicated going on about who it is one is attempting to please. And maybe it gives away too much about my orientation toward, you know, the proper way to do a clinical psychoanalysis. But I think that for me, it's something about pleasing a quote-unquote other. But that's a very abstract notion, and that other is a part of me. It's not a reader out there in the land of people who buy books, but it's something in me that expects of me something that's hopefully a little bit smarter and more funny and entertaining than what I could come up with easily. It's demanding somehow. It's a demand.
And aside from there's also the motorcycles. There's also the motorcycles. What is it about the motorcycle that you find so compelling?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure. I've been thinking about that recently because it just keeps on coming up. Why do I write about motorcycles? And well, I have a natural autobiographical link to motorcycles because I spent my entire 20s riding them, working on them, racing them. And I've just always been into bikes since I was little. My dad had a very rare British motorcycle called a Vincent Black Shadow, and that is now more or less mine. I mean, my dad's still alive, but my mother won't let him ride it. And so I've been restoring it and, you know, starting it kind of annually every year. And I don't know, I just, they interest me. They delight me, and it's material that I know. And I think that for me, the novel as a journey is most fun if it's a way to encounter or re-encounter worlds that I know something about. I don't ever choose subject matter that I would have to go and do a bunch of research on. I choose subject matter that I already care about and can, you know, go into sort of freehand without the aid of, you know, a lot of materials, research materials. And so that was one for me. And then I'm also interested in war and technology, and I'm not entirely done with the 20th century. And I started thinking about the motorcycle and the way that it was put to use in World War I and then again in World War II. And I'm into the futurists and how, and they came up with these sort of corny and not very fast looking paintings about speed. And so I started to imagine that there would just maybe be one of those guys, one wingnut, who decided to actually employ a sort of futurist verve in the world of industry and then become a businessman.
And finally, Made to Burn. well, motorcycles are closely associated with fiery death, but what is the fascination of Made to Burn?
Well, yeah, Fak ut Ardeat is a very small piece of a phrase from this Christian lament, the Stabat Mater. It's a very beautiful medieval lament. And I didn't know anything about that, but I was in a house in Italy that actually is inhabited by a Marxist professor, but used to belong to his mother, who was a fascist lawyer in Milan. And my friend assumed that the saying over her fireplace, Fak ut Ardeat, made to burn, was a reference to Gabriel D'Annunzio, which does make sense. And of course, it's a joke because you put wood there. And then I looked it up, and it's actually, from this medieval Christian hymn. And it just seemed to inform my novel. And there's something beautiful about it. I just also like even the way that those Latin words look on the page.
That was Rachel Kushner, author of The Flamethrowers from Scribner. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break.
Take my advice, the boys don't think twice. Last struggle's not academic. They want to drown every corrupt clown and lackey of the ruling class. Your kiss of death could be a Learjet. Radicals don't like the rich. It's too bourgeois to drive a big car, so it better be bulletproof. Off the road, bloody episode. Oh, why did you have to get in their way? You'll get to see red emergency if the boys blow out your kneecap. It's not a game when you become lame and they booby-trap your wheelchair. Please act discreet if you ever meet. Don't try to create a big scene. Don't try to run if you see a nun whose habit conceals a weapon. Be a Pison and she'll be gone if you don't talk to reporters. You get a leash if you don't kabish. The boys like
what? How is some of Rome on $5 a Day, an early 1980s song about the Red Brigades by XEX, not sure how to pronounce it, some high school kids from Central Jersey. Next up is Mark Mizrachi. His book on the rot of the U.S. managerial class, The Fracturing of the American Corporate Elite, is recently out from Harvard University Press. I've long thought that the rot of American society has been led by its ruling class, which would be a political blessing were there a credible revolutionary class around to take its place. But there's not, so a class society with a defective ruling class will be unusually defective. But that's my opinion. Here's Mark Mizrachi with his. I think a lot of people on first hearing of your thesis would say corporations, the corporate class, fragmented and ineffectual. I mean, they seem to run everything. They get their way in Washington. They don't have any political threat. They're rolling in profits. It's looking good for them. They look very powerful and secure. How are they fractured and ineffectual?
Well, I think that they're very good at getting favors for themselves specifically. So for their particular company, they've got lots of connections. They can get favors for themselves. The issue is there are a number of things that are important to businesses that they can't do individually. For example, healthcare, or for example, economic policy, and particular issues around the budget and the deficit and taxation. And what I'm arguing is that there was a time when they were able to act collectively to address these kinds of problems, and that they're not able to do that now. So healthcare, for example, is a huge problem for companies. Costs have gone through the roof. These companies are really being hurt by this, and yet they have not been able to get their act together to really address this problem on a national level.
I do want to return to the healthcare thing as a case study a little later, but let's go back into history and talk about the emergence of some of the organizations that corporate managers have used in the past, such as the CED. What was that about?
Well, in the period after, it was actually during World War II, there was a lot of concern because we had come out of the Great Depression and the war clearly provided the stimulus to get the economy started again. But there was a major concern among business leaders that once the war ended, we would sink right back into the Depression. And so they felt that there were a number of forward-looking business people who wanted to plan for the post-war economy. And the CED, the Committee for Economic Development, was established in 1942 by a couple of people who had business experience, but also were academics. Paul Hoffman was the primary founder. And originally there was cooperation from the government. So Jesse Jones, who was FDR's Commerce Secretary, was involved in some of these discussions. So the group originally consisted of leaders of a number of major corporations, people who were affiliated with the Federal Reserve Banks of various regions. Their idea, though, was that their perspective on economics was much more moderate and pragmatic than traditional business people had been. So in American history, most business people have been extremely conservative on most economic issues. They're for low taxes, low government spending, except perhaps on the military. They oppose labor unions, and they prefer to let the free market make most decisions. The leaders of a number of major companies in the period during and after World War II started to realize that it was necessary for the government to manage the economy, that the Great Depression had been caused to a great extent because there had not been enough government involvement. And they felt that, partly as a result of the New Deal, that the state had a role to play. And also another reason that they supported government intervention was because business people started to realize that it actually was to their benefit for the public to have money in their pockets, because many people believe that the Depression was caused by the fact that there was a high degree of production, but demand was too low because the general public, their wages were too low. And so the idea that the government would intervene and in some cases create jobs and sponsor transfer payments, it would put money in people's pockets, it would allow them to buy more goods, was actually good for business. And so many corporate leaders started to see that the old laissez-faire ideology wasn't really to their benefit. And that was a crucial component of the CED's ideology.
They had, to some degree, perhaps not embraced the New Deal, but at least reached some stage of grudging acceptance of it and labor unions and government intervention and all those early post-war decade phenomena.
Yes, they did. I mean, it was, you have to be careful when you talk about their reactions to unions. Now, I don't want to make it sound as if they really loved unions. They happily welcomed them into the fold. I think in an ideal world, they would have preferred to not have to deal with unions. But they recognized unions were not going away, and they were pragmatic about it. They decided, it's better to make our peace with the world as it is, as opposed to try to fight something and fight a war that we probably can't win. So they decided to try to work with the unions, and to some extent this benefited them because there were a lot of radicals in the unions, and there was a kind of tacit agreement made after World War II that the companies would accept the existence of the major unions, but the unions would make sure they got rid of the radicals and kept their own workers reasonably in line, and then in exchange the companies would give the workers relatively high wages and relatively good benefits. And that plan worked out fairly well for a number of years.
And that business consensus was reflected in the presidency of Eisenhower, wasn't it?
Yes, and so I think Eisenhower is a very good example of the predominant worldview at that time among the elite, both the political elite and the economic elite. He actually brought a number of CED leaders into his administration. One of the things I need to point out about the CED is that most of these people were Republicans. We're not talking about a bunch of business liberals at that time. These were people who were traditional Republicans, and Eisenhower himself was seen as relatively conservative, but you look at it in historical, from the present, and Eisenhower comes across looking pretty liberal by today's standards. And there's one point in the book where I have a quote from a letter that Eisenhower wrote to his brother, Edgar. His brother apparently had written a letter complaining about, why haven't you killed the New Deal? Why are you continuing to support Social Security? And Eisenhower's response was, these are programs that a lot of people depend on, and it would be extremely disruptive for us to go in and try to destroy these programs. And moreover, you know, the people who really would like to do this are, you know, and he mentioned, you know who these people are. There are a few Texas oil men and others who are extremely conservative. And in fact, and Eisenhower used the exact word, he referred to these people as stupid. That was a reflection of where both corporate leadership and political leadership was at that time.
And if we look at some of the ancestry of the CED, you can see it in earlier in the 20th century in what James Weinstein called corporate liberalism, right?
Yeah, and I think that, you know, I'm not sure that that term is really the best term to use, but there was a group that Weinstein actually wrote about called the National Civic Federation that was formed at the beginning of the 20th century. And this included major business leaders of the time, and it does represent a good example of a historical predecessor to the CED. These were people who were very concerned about the growing radicalism of the labor movement, and also concerned about the fact that one of the things triggering this was just the abysmal working conditions that most people were functioning under. And they felt that in order to ensure that we don't have more radical politics, you know, we really need to find some way to accommodate the workers. And so the members of the National Civic Federation actually tried to get their fellow corporate leaders to accept independent labor unions. And they weren't ultimately successful in that. But they did have an influence on a number of companies that by the 1920s adopted what became known as welfare capitalism. And again, these were programs that were run by the companies, but they did provide things like health care for workers and in some cases pension plans and workers' compensation. And so even though these were administered by the companies and therefore, there was a certain degree of precariousness to them, the conditions for workers did improve as a result of that.
I'm speaking with Mark Mizrachi, author of The Fracturing of the American Corporate Elite from Harvard University Press. So all this started breaking apart in the 70s. So what were the forces breaking it apart?
Well, what happened in the early 1970s is a whole series of things came to a head. First of all, we had the economic problems domestically, which were a result of excessive spending on the Vietnam War, as well as to some extent the spending for the Lyndon Johnson's Great Society programs. And what that did is it put a certain inflationary pressure on the economy. There was a very tight labor market in the late 1960s. Unemployment was extremely low. That put upward pressure on wages, and that partly contributed to the increase in inflation that we started to see in the late 60s. That was one issue. A second issue was that in the period after World War II, the rest of the world was pretty much devastated by the war, and the United States came out of that as the world's dominant economic power, and we really didn't face any serious competition from anyone. But one of the problems there was that there weren't people outside of the U.S. who could afford to buy the products we were producing, and so one of the reasons for the Marshall Plan was to try to rebuild Europe, in part because we wanted consumers there to have enough money that they could buy American products. And so the thing about the Marshall Plan is it worked, but in some ways it worked too well. And so both in Europe and in Japan, which the U.S. also helped rebuild, these economies had really recovered by the 1960s. And so by the early 1970s, these American companies that for years had really experienced no serious competition, all of a sudden were facing all kinds of global competition. And they weren't prepared for it. They had gotten soft because they were in highly concentrated industries here, and they really had the markets to themselves. So that was a second issue. And then a third issue was that partly as a result of the protests against the Vietnam War and the student movement and the civil rights movement and a whole series of social movements that were occurring at that time, corporations came under fire. And so the legitimacy of American business really had suffered by the early 1970s. And so a number of people in the business community became fearful that the entire market system was under question now and that they really worried about whether capitalism could survive. And so with all of these forces occurring simultaneously, and then we had the energy crisis also, and then we started to experience economically for the first time in in memory the simultaneous appearance of high inflation and high unemployment, and economic policymakers didn't seem to be able to do anything about this. So with all these forces occurring simultaneously, American business saw themselves as under attack, under siege. And one of the things they started to do is they became increasingly aggressive toward labor unions. So they started to call into question some of the pragmatic approaches that they had used in earlier years, and they started to attack labor much more aggressively. The second thing is they became much more aggressive in attacking government regulation. They felt that regulation had gone too far. And so what we started to see in the 1970s was a reaction from business, from big business. They started to attack labor unions. They started to attack government regulation. And in doing this, they started to ally themselves with extreme right-wing conservatives whom they had shunned in earlier years. One of the interesting aspects of the post-war corporate elite was that they didn't want anything to do with the right. They really saw themselves as middle of the road and more moderate. And so when Barry Goldwater was nominated for president in 1964, many of the largest corporations supported Johnson. And by the early 1970s, though, they started to act collectively with these conservatives. And so we got this strong conservative push, not only from traditional conservatives, but also from large corporations. And they did this through funding foundations and also becoming much better organized politically. And another key thing that occurred at this time was the formation of the Business Roundtable. This was an organization that was formed in 1973. And what distinguished the Roundtable, first of all, these were people who were chief executives of Fortune 500 firms. So it, unlike the CED, which had included academics and people from nonprofit organizations, the Business Roundtable was made up exclusively of Fortune 500 CEOs. The second thing was that the goal of the Business Roundtable was explicitly to lobby for pro-business policies. So the CED had seen itself as operating in the larger national interest. Now, you know, you could argue that, in fact, they were simply representing their own class interests, but there was a degree of balance that you didn't see among other groups like, say, the National Association of Manufacturers or the Chamber of Commerce. And the Business Roundtable was more like those latter two groups. It was more moderate than they were, but again, unlike the CED, the Business Roundtable saw itself explicitly as a lobbying group for the interests of business. And so during the 1970s, the CED was still there and it was still pushing moderate policies, but then there was increasing conflict in that organization as well, and a number of its people felt that they should move in a more conservative direction. So by the late 1970s, big business, small business, traditional conservatives were all allied with one another, and they were all pushing very aggressively against the entire post-war liberal consensus. And they were very successful at it.
There were changes in the financial landscape, too, that the banks transitioned from being forces for cohesion and the kind of stability to being a source of fragmentation and disruption and disorder, didn't they?
Well, one of the things I argue in the book is that during the post-war period, the large commercial banks played a very specific role in which they were meeting places for the corporate elite. So if you looked at the boards of large commercial banks, they tended to consist of chief executives of leading non-financial corporations. So there was a point at which the board of Chemical Bank, for example, in the early 70s had 17 Fortune 500 CEOs. Chase Manhattan Bank in the early 1980s had 14 Fortune 500 CEOs. And one of the consequences of this, the banks don't have any particular interests in specific sectors of the economy. They're concerned about the economy as a whole. And so they tend to see things in a broader perspective. One of the outcomes of all these business leaders sitting on bank boards was that the leaders of the business community tended to adopt this broad, more moderate perspective. When you're looking at things in a from a broader perspective, you tend to see multiple sides of issues, and so you tend to adopt a more moderate perspective. And so through director interlocks in which the banks were in the center, the banks played this important moderating role for the corporate elite. What happened in the early 1980s was there was a series of technological developments in which companies became less dependent on commercial banks for their investment capital. And as a result, the banks were no longer making money from their traditional function of lending. And as a result of that, they had to look for other sources of income. And what they tried to do was become more like investment banks. So they started focusing on fee-for-service activity. They became involved in advising companies on things like currency swaps and capital market policies. And as a result, they actually stopped inviting chief executives of leading companies to sit on their board. So what you start to see across the 1980s is the banks becoming less and less central in the corporate interlock network. So whereas from the late 1800s through virtually the entire 20th century up until the mid-1980s, the one constant was that the big New York commercial banks were always in the center of the network. They were always the ones that were the most connected to other firms. You start to see a drop-off, a very sharp drop in the 1980s. So by the mid-1990s, the big commercial banks were no longer in the center of the network. And what that did was it meant that you no longer had this source of cohesiveness for the corporate community. But there was one additional factor that I think also contributed to the fragmentation of business. Actually, there are a couple of other factors. The first thing I argue in the book is that one of the reasons that the leaders of the business community had been relatively cohesive in the post-war period is because they faced a common adversary. So they faced a relatively strong labor movement and a relatively strong and highly legitimate government. And this contributed to their ability to act collectively because they saw themselves as having the same interests. One of the ironies of the success that big business experienced in the late 1970s and early 80s was they greatly weakened the labor movement and they greatly weakened the role of the state. But as a result of this, they really didn't have any reason to be organized anymore. They no longer faced a common enemy, and so they all started pursuing their own interests. And so you see this, for example, in the 1986 tax reform, where companies went in, individual firms went in lobbying for very specific favors, but they didn't act collectively, and many people see the 1986 tax reform as a defeat for big business. The other factor that was really important was the acquisition wave of the 1980s. You know, we had had a number of big merger waves in American history prior to the 80s, including in the 1960s, there was this huge conglomerate merger wave. But what made the 1980s different was that this acquisition wave was not driven by managers. This wave was driven by outsiders, people called corporate raiders, who were looking for companies that they saw as undervalued because the stock market had been relatively low throughout the 1970s and early 80s. And so a number of people saw these companies as ripe for takeover. And what happened during the 1980s was, after almost a century of complete stability, one-third of the Fortune 500 disappeared within that one decade. And so if you were a manager, if you were a CEO of a company, you know, in the 1950s, you had a high degree of autonomy. Yes, you had to deal with labor and you had to deal with the government, but you didn't really have the stockholders of your company breathing down your back. You had a high degree of discretion in terms of your ability to make policy for the firm, and your position tended to be very secure. Well, by the 1980s, with all these hostile takeovers occurring, no CEO felt secure under those conditions. And so it was much more difficult to think about, well, the long-term conditions of the larger business community or the society as a whole when next month you could be out of a job because your company's been acquired. And so this put a tremendous amount of pressure on corporate CEOs. So one of the things you observed during the beginning in the 1980s is the CEO tenure starts to decline sharply. So between 1980 and 2000, CEO tenure dropped by almost a third. And some of this may have been voluntary, but much of it was involuntary. We witnessed a lot more CEO firings during this period. And because of this, it wasn't as easy for a company executive to be concerned about these longer-term issues. They really had to worry about the bottom line, number one, and also increasing the value of the firm's stock for the shareholders. And this was something that companies, American companies, had not experienced for almost a century.
That was Mark Mizrachi, author of The Fracturing of the American Corporate Elite, from Harvard University Press. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of Haydn's setting of the Stabat Mater prayer that Rachel Kushner talked about earlier, performed by the English Concert and Choir under Trevor Pinnock. Till next week, bye.